June is a celebration of pride. President Barack Obama this year joined in the recognition as he proclaimed June 2014 as Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Pride Month. On this week's 51%, we'll take a look at the momentum of legalizing same-sex marriage in the U.S.
It's not something I ever thought would happen in my lifetime.
We'll visit a state that bans same-sex marriage and where a pride movement has sprung up in a small town. Plus, a new publication about same-sex weddings is joining the magazine world. And we'll take a look at a female first at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
And everyone only had one fellow. No need to remember when.
A village in New York State, roughly 85 miles north of New York City, 10 years ago became a driving force behind the gay marriage movement nationwide. New Paltz recently held its annual Hudson Valley LGBTQ Pride March and Festival, but this time it was to celebrate a milestone, the same-sex marriage ceremonies that were performed a decade ago. The founder of the campaign to win marriage equality nationwide, a man Newsweek and the Daily Beast once dubbed the godfather of gay marriage, served as Grand Marshal of the Pride March. I spoke with him as well as the co-Grand Marshals about the country's direction when it comes to legalizing same-sex marriages. Village of New Paltz Mayor Jason West presided over 25 same-sex marriages February 27, 2004. New York State did not recognize the marriages. In June 2011, Governor Andrew Cuomo signed a bill legalizing same-sex marriage in New York.
I was actually amazed that it happened so rapidly, to be honest with you. I mean, we're talking, what, 7 years, which is a very short time in cultural change. And so it actually was pretty amazing. It's not something I ever thought would happen in my lifetime.
That's Ulster County resident Suzanne McHugh. She and Anna Mae Schuler were married in New Paltz in 2004 and married again 5 months after same-sex marriage became legal in New York.
I've been through a lot of cultural changes in my life. For instance, I was almost thrown out of college for being a lesbian. And I got called into the dean of women's office, and she said, "I hear one more rumor about you, and you're out."
That was at then Slippery Rock State College in Pennsylvania. McHugh says she kept very quiet after that and graduated in 1970. Evan Wolfson is founder and president of New York City-based Freedom to Marry.
Freedom to Marry is a national campaign, and our goal has always been to win marriage nationwide. The work is not done until we have ended this discrimination, not just in one state or one place or part of the country, but throughout the United States. And so the work of winning, of course, is always local. It's about conversations we can each have with the people around us. It's about the legal and political work necessary to end discrimination in the states and build toward creating the climate that will enable the Supreme Court to bring the country to national resolution.
Wolfson, named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time in 2004, talks about how the events in New Paltz sparked national change.
What was important about the marriage ceremonies that took place 10 years ago in New Paltz and the personal statements that people were making is that they broke the silence and they talked about their lives, their love, why they wanted to share in the freedom to marry, and non-gay allies also spoke up and said this is important as a matter of fairness, as a matter of living up to our country's promise. And although it didn't survive legally at that point, it was an example of how, by talking about why marriage matters, by asking others to think it through, we could change hearts and minds in a way that would change the climate, in a way that would lead decision makers to change the law. And so it's an example of what we need to keep doing, because we still, of course, do not yet have the freedom to marry in 31 states.
Schuler, who is approaching 70 years old, says the practical matter of benefits like health care coverage spouses share are important, especially as one grows older.
And you don't think about that when you're 40 and 50, but you start to think about it when you're approaching 60, and you go, damn, I want what the other part of the world has. It's going to be a struggle when I'm on my micro little pension. My pension is $84 a month. doesn't go very far.
Meanwhile, Wolfson cites the advances since the Newport same-sex marriage ceremonies.
We now have 19 states, including New York, in which same-sex couples can share in the freedom to marry, plus our nation's capital, the District of Columbia. That's about 44% of the American public now lives in a state where gay people can marry, up from zero a decade ago, up from zero at the time of the New Paltz marriage ceremonies.
Wolfson, who during the 1990s served as co-counsel in the Hawaii marriage case that launched the ongoing movement for the freedom to marry, discusses why he thinks legalizing same-sex marriage has gained momentum.
When we didn't yet have the freedom to marry, it was easier for the anti-gay opponents to give people all kinds of scary rhetoric and for people to worry about what might happen and to not fully understand the importance of ending marriage discrimination. But once we won the freedom to marry in the first state, then the next state, and then the next, people began to see with their own eyes, families helped and no one hurt. The gays didn't use up all the marriage licenses. Nothing was taken away from anyone. What we had was people happy, people able to strengthen their families, a good for many that took nothing away from anyone. And that's why people have come to see that this is a good thing.
Wolfson says despite the progress, there is much work to be done in advancing the freedom to marry. Small-town Utah is not the likeliest of places for a growing LGBTQ pride movement. But the Moab Pride Festival, established in 2011 and now entering its fourth year, calls itself the nation's second-largest small-town pride festival. In these places, where everyone knows everyone, it can be hard to stand up for something you believe in, something that sets you apart. But maybe, as Freedom to Marry's Evan Wolfson pointed out earlier, it's these hometowns that have the best shot at pioneering a community-driven atmosphere of tolerance and understanding. Jennifer Jarrett reports.
Moab, Utah is a small town, tucked away down in the southeast corner of the state. And when I say small, I mean, you know, small. There are maybe a dozen or so streetlights, no big box stores. The city population hovers around 5,000. And this is Utah, right? It's a pretty conservative state. So it's not exactly the kind of place that first pops into your mind when you think about pioneering LGBTQ pride movements. But in the summer of 1993, Connell O'Donovan and Keith Randall planted a seed.
We got 11 of our closest friends, four gay guys and a bunch of lesbians and straight allies, and we started off at Woody's, right? You know, carrying like some rainbow flags and like a few signs.
Tambourines and drums.
Yeah. And, you know, and marched up one side of Main Street, crossed the street, down the other side of Main Street, and back to Woody's.
They called it March on Moab. And as far as we know, it was the town's first gay pride parade. They did it again the next summer. Then things were pretty quiet for a while. But in 2011, the pride movement really surfaced in Moab. This time with a new group of organizers, a mission statement, and a full-blown festival. Woody's is still here, but those 11 people back in the early 90s have become nearly 500 marchers in Moab Pride's visibility parade today. Visibility is an important tenet of Pride movements. You know, stand up, be seen for who you are and what you believe in. But that's not always easy to do in small towns. Something as straightforward as just being yourself can feel like an act of bravery. This is Audrey Baird talking about her experience.
It was a little bit harder just because you don't really know what you should do, if you should come out or if you should just keep it to yourself, because you really don't know how people are going to react because everyone knows everyone.
Audrey's mom, Donna Metzler, continues.
I think as a mother watching a child come out in high school, it's very difficult. But it really brings you closer to your child and closer to being accepting of all people and then being an advocate for people from every walk of life.
Donna is also the city manager for Moab. She thinks a climate of acceptance is community-driven.
I think it's important for community leaders to really take leadership positions on issues of tolerance and diversity, and I'm really proud the city of Moab has done that.
In fact, the city of Moab issued a proclamation recognizing the Moab Pride Festival as a time for the whole town to celebrate its dignity, its shared humanity. Here's Moab's mayor, known locally as simply Mayor Dave.
Hopefully the example that we've set is that, you know, there's room enough in this world for all of us. And, you know, we're all God's people, and let's celebrate that, and let's honor that, and let's enjoy that.
So even in these unlikeliest of places, in red state, rural America, folks can still surprise us if we let them. This is community member Daniel Suelo.
We were bracing ourselves for a lot of negative reaction, and there was none, absolutely none. And we're like, wow, this is small town Utah, and we can have a pride festival. And it's like there's something changing in our society.
And maybe that's where small towns have big roles to play in the coming pride movements. Maybe that's where we have an edge, because it's out here, in these places we grew up, where we can shift the focus from just visibility to kindness and understanding. Local resident Thatcher Vogts.
For the most part, the gay and queer culture has been accepted in the metropolises and the large cities in the United States. And now it's really about expanding it to rural communities and individual families, and making it more personal and about your neighbor and about the people that you see in the grocery store and at your high school. And I think that to open up eyes and hearts and minds, it needs to happen on a personal level.
You know, just because you were raised small town doesn't mean you have to stay small-minded.
Yeah, I like that. Good quote.
In Moab, Utah, I'm Jennifer Jarrett.
June is busting out all over.
Runs across the Nile, pushes and the Rumpin River, pushes every little wheel that wheels beside a pig.
In a month often associated with weddings, a new publication is hitting the magazine marketplace. Equal, spelled EQL, is a biannual print magazine dedicated to gay and lesbian dream weddings. The second issue is due out in the fall. Publisher Leslie Hurd says Equal is the first national publication of its kind.
It is wedding month, one of the typical wedding months, of course, and as well as Pride Month that your publication is launching. So why did what is the significance of kind of the duality of that?
Well, having published wedding magazines for 25 years, and June being one of the most common months to get married, as well as it being, you know, Gay Pride Month. It's a beautiful month to get married, and we thought it was ideal in two ways, because it's obviously important to the gay community, and that is who the magazine is created for, and so I think it fits in two different ways.
Now, you call the publication a celebration of same-sex marriages, and does that go beyond the traditional bridal books when it comes to editorial content? How will this differ not only in who you're marketing towards, but in terms of content?
Well, I mean, my other magazines have been, full of beautiful photos and interesting stories in many different destinations, and basically the only difference is that same-sex marriages are, you know, they're still beautiful celebrations. The women still want to look lovely. The men want to look dapper. They want to celebrate in beautiful locations. It just happens to be that they're the same sex. So it's a lookbook. It's upscale. And it is, to celebrate with beautiful photos and features to help guide the gay community.
Now, why did you launch this now? Why not last year, the year before, wait another year? Why is now the right time?
Well, I think it's obviously more and more states each month, as we see a new state seems to join in with legalizing gay marriage. And, the more states that are available to be married in, certainly makes this a more relevant, specific project to the gay community.
Economically, did it just kind of meld together that the timing was right, as you mentioned, with the number of states recognizing and legalizing same-sex marriage, along with the economy having picked up recently?
Absolutely. And, you know, I also follow, you know, what is working as far as magazine. We know that, as you mentioned, it's internet. Everything is internet these days. But as far as destination and niche publications, they actually, the number is growing and the success is increasing. There were 246 magazines launched in 2013, and those that are most successful are specific niche publications, which is what this will be, of course, and also it will be very upscale with, you know, as I say, containing beautiful photography and stories throughout the country of brides and grooms. It's a national publication, and we've reached out all over the nation to some of the top photographers as well as venues to feature in the magazine.
Is it fair to say you expect, at least at the beginning or maybe the first two issues, you know, the spring and the fall, to be strong sales, you know, subscriptions in certain areas of the country as opposed to others?
Well, I would say certainly, you know, the East Coast is a great area. Many of the states originally are on the East Coast where gay marriage is legal. Obviously, New York is a very focused area on in gay marriage, as well as California. So we have some venues in California. We even have one in Hawaii. But I would say primarily East and West Coast, but also we have some in Chicago. So we're really trying to serve the nation and reach out to all those states where gay marriage is legal.
Do you have ideas to expand this in any way, shape, or form?
I would say ideally what I think we would like to do is be able to expand it so that we may have regional equal magazines. We may have you know, equal magazine for the East Coast, equal for the West Coast, Midwest, and hopefully it will grow enough so that we can, as I say, have individual magazines for each area of the country.
So what are the hot trends?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think there are necessarily any specific hot trends. The only, I mean, I think one of the differences is they, you know, tend to have smaller weddings. The weddings tend to be, you know, 100 or 150 versus 250 to 300, 400, which is more common, I think, for heterosexual couples. But also, you know, they try to make it very intimate. It's usually a very, very connected group of people, friends and family at the weddings, because it's so important, you know, that they're able to get married after, you know, many years of, for some couples, being together and not being able to do that. So it's a very, very important celebration.
But what does it say about our society that now the time is right for this kind of publication to come out?
Well, I think society is becoming more tolerant, and society, you know, generally, more and more people are realizing that we are all equal, and, you know, men marrying men and women marrying women, again, it's just they happen to be the same sex. It doesn't necessarily mean that the marriage or the wedding or, you know, anything is that different from what we, you know, heterosexual couples would be celebrating. It's just a celebration of their love, and I think more and more people are realizing that.
Is there anything else that maybe proved a challenge or was different about putting out this bridal publication rather than, you know, other than the previous ones?
I would say no. I mean, having launched publications in different parts of the world, you know, including Bermuda, the Virgin Islands, and Martha's Vineyard, Cape Cod area, it's always a challenge to launch the first issue of any publication because there's nothing, you know, people don't have something tangible to look at. They have it's an idea, and it's not complete. So I think once the first issue is in the hands of people, it will be very, very desirable to be a part of the magazine.
You know, maybe you could just give us a flavor.
Well, it's again, it's a lookbook. It's about showing people all of the different possibilities, all of the different beautiful venues. There are a number of other smaller LGBT magazines that have launched, but they don't really cover the national venues as I don't believe we will. We also have 12 incredible features of different couples, from beach weddings to castle weddings to mountaintop weddings. I mean, we've really, to the boathouse in Central Park, we've really tried to do a nice combination of all different possible venues that would be ideal to have the perfect wedding. And we've worked with those brides and grooms and created stories and collected their photos, and those will be in the magazine.
And then finally, my last question, Leslie, is what for you will define success?
What for me will define success? Well, that the community finds the magazine to be useful and worthwhile, and that it assists the gay community in choosing where to get married and guiding them to, have the best possible day that we can create. And that's the vision, that we've been able to create for many other couples in Bermuda and the Virgin Islands for many years. And we want to be able to do that, throughout the country for the gay community.
That was publisher Leslie Hurd talking about Equal, her new publication on gay weddings. And now we turn to an institution that represents a different kind of relationship, one of serving the United States. Females were first admitted to the U.S. Military Academy at West Point in 1976. Of the 1,064 cadets who received their diplomas in May 2014, 186 were women. President Obama delivered the graduation speech, noting another female first.
Among you is the first all-female command team, Aaron Maudlin and Austin Barth.
Then cadet from Albuquerque, New Mexico, now Second Lieutenant Aaron Maudlin, was also class valedictorian. In addition to honoring the cadets, Mr. Obama used the stage to deliver a foreign policy speech, and after Cheryl Lee Ralph looked on as her stepson graduated, she celebrated the first mentioned by the president.
Long speech, but a content-driven speech. He said some very important things, including that this is the first class that has a full regiment of what? Females, yes!
Leaders.
And they were all leaders, and not one of them was the GOAT. Thank you. I loved it.
That's her husband, Pennsylvania State Senator Vincent Hughes, chuckling in the background. The GOAT at West Point is the person to finish last in the class, and while this is the last piece for this week's show, it's the first of many to come where I will take the reins as your host and producer. And I share Cheryl Lee Ralph's enthusiasm.
Females, yes!
During 51%, we will share with you several firsts, lasts, and the gamut in between. GOAT or no GOAT? Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1300. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%.